Welcome to the Political Risk Brief. My name is Jonathan Barron of Barron Public Affairs. Thank you for joining us at the intersection of policy, politics, business, and demographics. Our topic today, Taiwan Syndrome, confusion in Washington about the U.S.-China relationship. Joining me as always, Jeremy Furchgott.
Great to be here.
And Johnny Pfluger.
Thanks, Jonathan.
This is a special podcast edition that we decided to record in light of recent events which really have put Taiwan and U.S.-China competition at the center of the debate in Washington. And arguably, no single issue will have a greater impact on the trajectory of the United States in the coming years and decades than the resolution or failed resolution of U.S.-China tension. And I'm delighted to have Jeremy to lead this conversation as the person who heads our China practice. And Jeremy, remind me, when we add up all the major projects that we have done in recent years, including current projects, how many major studies have we done of China and Chinese behavior and related topics?
We've done 8 standalone studies.
Yeah. And those are typically 1 year plus projects. And Jeremy has led those. So really substantial work in this area and just delighted, again, to bring to bear so much work and wisdom and insight, Jeremy, that you've developed over recent months and years. And I want to begin by just establishing that Washington really is in the grips of a panic over Taiwan, perhaps a justified panic. I don't use the word panic to dismiss it by any means, but something really has gripped the town. And I think one of the most respected exponents of this view is Elbridge Colby, who is a recognized foreign policy expert, a Trump administration official, and he recently really described what's happening, and some of the stakes.
The Taiwan fight is really about ultimately our own interests, and it's about China and China's ability to dominate the world's largest market area, which is Asia. And I think that's becoming increasingly clear that those stakes are so significant. I mean, I think the American people understand it. I mean, they can see it in things like deindustrialization, the influence over some of our major corporations and elite institutions and so forth.
Before we go to Jeremy for his extended insights, I want to turn to you, Johnny, just to give our audience our sense at the firm of how China sits in the imagination of Washington and the defense intelligence community and all of the private sector forces around that community.
China is many things in a Washington context. China is a mirror up to which many of our leading business executives and policymakers hold up U.S. civilization and judge U.S. civilization, especially in the realm of technology development for defense contractors and many corporate interests that make their money from the government. China is the justification for new programs, new products, new services that are needed for the U.S. to outcompete the Chinese. For many China hands, as the saying was under the British Empire, the East is a career. It is a massive professional opportunity. And because China is outside of Western civilization, it is a country, a culture that attracts individuals who would find, for example, dealing with the nitty-gritty of U.S.-Russian relations to be more complicated. And I think it is a venue for a lot of dreams and hopes and aspirations and desires beyond the narrow realm of U.S.-China relations.
So, Jeremy, to that point, Taiwan, although certainly a current, very important, specific foreign policy question, also provides, I think, an outstanding opportunity to explore the gap in how Washington and China experts generally approach China and how China actually sees the world and how China actually understands the United States. And as you've observed, and as we've observed over the years, there's a huge deficit between those two things. And so provide our audience an overview of that gap, of that chasm.
Sure. I think there are really 3 big areas, which maybe we can dive into over the course of this podcast. The 3 are predictions, ambiguity, and sovereignty. Just a little preview of each one. The first is that Americans are fascinated by predictions about China. There have been a flurry of predictions in the past year or two, predictions coming out of D.C. of China invading Taiwan. For example, in March of 2021, Admiral Davidson gave his assessment of the likelihood of a conflict.
I think our concerns are manifest here during this decade, not only on the development, the numbers of, you know, ships, aircraft, rockets, et cetera, that they've put in the field, but the way they're advancing those capabilities as well, in combination with everything that you just cited, Hong Kong and Xinjiang and Tibet and the line of actual control in the South China Sea and the East China Sea. I worry that they're accelerating their ambitions to supplant the United States and our leadership role in the rules-based international order, which they've long said that they want to do that by 2050. I'm worried about them moving that target closer. Taiwan is clearly one of their ambitions before then, and I think the threat is manifest during this decade, in fact, in the next 6 years.
And there have been many other similar predictions of conflict, when the conflict would occur, exactly what the conflict would look like in certain cases. So there's a lot of interest in predictions. This is one area of misunderstanding. The second has to do with red lines, clarity, and ambiguity. A common instinct by experts in D.C. is to say that the United States needs to reinforce red lines or otherwise reinforce its position around China and Taiwan. And in our estimation, China is actually much more comfortable with ambiguity, and clarity can be very destabilizing. And so I believe that reinforcing clarity can have all sorts of unintended consequences that people in D.C. have not thought through very much. The third is that Americans have a big blind spot around sovereignty. From China's point of view, Taiwan is really an issue of sovereignty. Whether it's justified or not, that's how the Chinese perceive it. The United States really has, I think, trouble understanding sovereignty because we're not party to any major sovereignty disputes. And so this creates a lack of awareness of certain things that are more common in other parts of the world. For example, in the Middle East, there are very serious sovereignty disputes. Israel, for example. Russia, of course, now there are sovereignty issues there. But the United States is, thankfully, not part of these kinds of sovereignty issues. So we have trouble understanding sovereignty, I think.
And Jeremy, what's fascinating to your analysis is that in many ways, the United States and China are a perfect mismatch. They're really, I would say, almost exact opposites on these three very important questions or characteristics. And talk a little bit about why that is and what that is and the implications of that mismatch.
Sure. There's a very strong mismatch, as you pointed out, Jonathan. In predictions, for example, Americans love to speculate. There's a whole industry in D.C. of people who make predictions. Who's going to win the next election? Is such and such regulation going to have such and such characteristics? Who's going to vote which way on a particular bill? There are all sorts of people engaging in predictions. I'm not saying this to dismiss these predictions. They're very important. Our society would not be able to function without them. The way Chinese society is structured, predictions are very different. Predictions often are in the form of what the Chinese government would label as rumors. The Chinese government publicly has expressed its concern about rumors and the destabilizing nature of these rumors. We don't have these concerns in the United States. Predictions also in China are a way of having outside views validate certain trajectories for the future. We've seen areas in which the Chinese government has leaned on the work of Western predictions to really inform Chinese policy. And so the idea of external predictions is very important in China, but not really something that we have very much of in the United States. If you look at the political industry in D.C., it's actually remarkable how truly isolated it is from what's happening in other countries. You don't have major European polling firms, for example, setting up offices in D.C. It's actually the other way around. You have American pollsters working in other democracies around the world. So our whole industry, our whole system of predictions is so contrary to how China operates.
And moreover, in the United States and in Washington specifically, people make lots of predictions, as you're pointing out, but there's very little accountability for being wrong. So there's just this regular flow of predictions by credentialed experts that turn out to be wrong. And those mistakes, those failed predictions, don't generally undermine the credibility, the credentials of the predictor.
Right. You move on to the next prediction.
And so that's also a strange dynamic in the United States, which, again, makes our system very comfortable with predictions. And we tend to think that predictions don't have much consequence. And they don't have much consequence in our system.
Right. Until we start making predictions about other countries' systems, and that can have all sorts of consequences for those countries, which we'll talk about. Another major area of difference has to do with clarity versus ambiguity. Americans really like clarity. The way American management culture has been really for at least decades, maybe longer, is that there should be clear responsibility, clear accountability, clear definitions. And Chinese organizations often function in the opposite way. There are just countless stories of Americans dealing with Chinese companies who will report, for example, three different sets of books for a company, or who will report parallel departments in a company, both departments performing the same function, but with a deliberate duplication, or executives whose job titles don't correspond to what they do. And this goes beyond organizational behavior. China's border with India, for example, has not been demarcated. After over half a century of conflict, it seems that the Chinese side is much more comfortable with lack of clarity. So clarity is a very big area of difference between the United States and China, and really ripe for unintended consequences.
And Jeremy, talk a little bit about how ambiguity is seen in the Chinese system as a very useful device. It's not a negative. It's often seen and deployed as a positive.
Well, it's really a great mechanism to preserve optionality. The Chinese system is very agile. It's hard to talk about these things in kind of generalizations, but I have to just do my best here. But there are reasons why manufacturing has taken off in China. Chinese factories are able to turn around new products, new tooling, very, very quickly compared to what other countries have been able to do. There's just a certain agility and comfort with change and tinkering, which is so remarkable in China. And that comes with a lack of clarity. I remember a year or two ago, one of the major education companies in China announced that it was coming out with a new line of fleeces.
And down jackets.
Yes, that's right, Johnny, down jackets. And in the United States, you wouldn't see a company in the services business start getting into garment manufacturing. But in China, companies have just very diversified business models, and that's been an incredible advantage to them in many ways. At a more micro level, at the level of the individual, it also enables people to avoid confrontation. Take the issue of the India border, for example. If I were in charge of some sector of the border on the Chinese side, and if something happened, I'd be able to go to my superiors and plausibly say, oh, well, the border's actually not there, it's somewhere else. You know, I have that wiggle room. And so it preserves the status quo. It prevents issues from getting out of control. And China's been able to do that masterfully with Taiwan. Taiwan is not exactly a country in certain senses. It is not treated as a country formally by most other nations around the world. But it's also not treated as part of China. It's just this very unusual circumstance. It's in a very unclear position. Taiwan's status is truly ambiguous. And Americans look at this ambiguous status and, in a very well-meaning way, seek to impose clarity on it. Is Taiwan a country, yes or no? How do we impose a clear definition on Taiwan? But the truth is that Taiwan has survived for over 70 years in a state of ambiguity, and that ambiguity, I believe, has enabled potential tensions, or, you know, real tensions, to simmer and not get out of control.
Well, and again, in our system, we believe very strongly that clarity and transparency produces stability. You want people to have clear expectations, clear standards, and that avoids misunderstanding. And that's true largely within the United States and our culture. But when applied to China, that could be disastrous.
Absolutely. And so I think we're just in a situation here where the conversation in D.C. is having real policy consequences and is pushing Taiwan in this direction where a showdown with China is becoming more inevitable because of well-intentioned efforts to create clarity.
I think there's a good example of this in some of the recent comments, I think very well-intentioned, by former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo.
While the United States should continue to engage the People's Republic of China as a sovereign government, America's diplomatic recognition of the 23 million freedom-loving Taiwanese people and its legal, democratically elected government can no longer be ignored, avoided, or treated as secondary.
On the Chinese side, you very often find Chinese state-run media quoting U.S. government statements and trying to prove how the United States itself actually recognizes the PRC's sovereignty over Taiwan. And they don't seem to realize that U.S. government statements might not be internally consistent all the time. And that's okay. That's how our system operates. We may say that we do not recognize Taiwan as a country, but in other areas we may behave as if we do treat it as a country. There can be a lot of internal inconsistency within the U.S. system, and to many in D.C. that is frustrating, that lack of consistency. But to China, it is, I think, not so much frustrating as really bewildering and confusing because such a level of internal chaos as they see it must be unacceptable within a country as successful and sophisticated as the United States is.
Johnny, speak a little bit to how Washington-centered Cold War nostalgia impacts views and policies on China.
I think your prompt, Jonathan, gets to one of the themes I raised earlier, which is the notion of diplomats, policymakers, foreign policy thinkers wanting to find a place where they can do deals. And they look back and have studied very closely the opening of China, thanks to Henry Kissinger and the Nixon administration. And they say to themselves, China is a place where I, as an official, whether a junior official or a senior official, can do some sort of deal where I can negotiate and produce a good outcome for the United States. And whether it's steel tariffs or access by U.S. financial services companies or auditors to the Chinese market, there's this perpetual quest to do deals with the people who are running the People's Republic of China. And I think that makes it unique. I don't think there is the same character to U.S.-Russian relations, for example, that exists in U.S.-Chinese relations. That archetype of doing a transaction, much in the way that a corporate development executive at a big company would think of their role, has really become institutionalized and persisted and grown and become a major part of U.S.-China relations.
And I think there's a part of the American political community among China hawks that really wants the competition or conflict with China to be another version of the U.S.-Soviet competition. So for anybody who came of age during that period, and that describes most of the policymakers currently on the scene, I think it's very easy to apply or, in fact, misapply that construct.
And it's certainly the case also with some of the very strong advocacy in terms of recognizing Taiwan as a country. There's certainly a nostalgia for the much stronger culture of support for Taiwan that existed at the height of the Cold War. And I think hawks on the right, Republicans who have moved in a anti-establishment direction, look back at the establishment of normalized trade relations with China and closer relations with China. And they think of, for example, the disposition toward China of former President George H.W. Bush, who famously, while playing tennis, used to mock the Taiwanese cause by speaking of unleashing Chiang to make fun of Chiang Kai-shek. And I think going back to that advocacy for the Taiwanese position is a way of infusing right-of-center foreign policy with a little bit of a populist perspective against the establishment that has led us into the status quo where we exist currently.
And I think for many people who associate themselves with the pro-Taiwan cause in the United States, and I myself have been part of that over the years and have great respect for what Taiwan has accomplished, which is incredibly impressive, it's the convenience of applying a Cold War model can lead in some very questionable directions. And not only that, but I think it prevents or allows hawks to avoid some of the hard thinking. So I'll just relate that I recently was in a conversation with a very senior, well-known China hawk, someone who's considered a real expert on U.S. defense policy and intelligence. And this person was making a strong case that the U.S. should go to war to defend Taiwan. And I asked, and I genuinely was interested in the answer, I asked, what assessment have you made or studied of, you know, Taiwan's willingness and capability to defend itself in such a scenario? And this policymaker hadn't made such an assessment. And so I thought that was surprising, given the seriousness of this issue. And again, I think part of why that happens is not because this person isn't smart and capable, they are, but rather because, again, we're just very comfortable slipping into a certain structure of conflict and competition, which I think does not necessarily apply here. And as you referenced, Johnny, the U.S.-Soviet economic relationship was a small fraction of the U.S.-China relationship. There was an energy relationship with the Soviet Union. There was on commodities and certain grains, et cetera.
And we also have to acknowledge that there's a major human capital relationship. One of the major initiatives undertaken by the U.S. government over the last 5 years has been rooting out Chinese espionage. And that has been pursued with such vigor that there are now instances where Chinese Americans, immigrants from China to the United States, allege that they have been persecuted because of family ties with China, travel back to China to see elderly parents and so forth. And that didn't exist during Soviet times, or at least to the same degree. You didn't have people who were critical to the human capital development of the United States who had enduring ties to such an extent with the Soviet Union. And that's another difference from 50 years ago.
And so as a result of that human capital relationship and the trade in goods and services, even a limited conflict, if such a thing is possible, with China would look nothing like what a comparable limited conflict with the Soviet Union produced. If there had been some U.S.-Soviet direct conflict in part of Europe or elsewhere, not indirect through proxies, but direct, yes, that would have been tremendously risky, could have resulted in a nuclear war. But if it hadn't, it would have been manageable in terms of the U.S. economy and certainly the bilateral U.S.-Soviet relationship.
Yeah. For example, our higher education sector in 1975 wasn't totally dependent on Chinese graduate students. If the U.S. and China entered into a military conflict, I think there is a, I haven't looked at the numbers, but I think there would have to be a federal bailout of institutions of higher education who for some period of time would not have graduate student populations.
And that's not to say that the U.S. should not, under certain circumstances, confront China and take a very hard line, up to and including perhaps military action. But it's somewhat surprising, or maybe it's unsurprising, that so few people in Washington have really thought through the practical consequences.
And we've looked at this pretty carefully over the past couple of years. We've looked at supply chains of various critical goods. And overall, there's a lot of awareness in the Washington, D.C. system that economic reliance is a potential problem. But there tends to be very little specificity. There tends to be very little specific analysis of how particular industries would be affected by various geopolitical disruptions.
And so, for example, in the case of a conflict, how would, in fact, the U.S. replace the antibiotics or other medicines made by China with other sources? And you see almost, as you say, Jeremy, almost no real discussion of what that would look like. There's almost a hope model that somehow it will work out, but that's probably not a great plan.
And this is not to say that because of our economic reliance on China, we are advocating any particular policy measures in terms of the defense of Taiwan or other related things. It's just there are consequences that we think have been unexplored. And if you look at publicly available information about war games and studies and other types of outputs from the DC policy community, there's just very little that addresses these kinds of consequences.
They're very focused on anti-ship warfare and how the U.S. will deal with Chinese missiles that have been developed to knock our ships out of the sea. But based on the press coverage I've read, they don't extend far beyond that topic.
Jeremy, turning to the topic of sovereignty, the third of your three key themes, walk our audience through what that's all about.
So our audience may be familiar with the so-called One China policy. What the One China policy says is that there is one entity that is China, and that that entity covers both sides of the Taiwan Strait, but it is unclear who really is in charge, what exactly China is beyond that. So what does this mean? What this really means is that U.S. recognition of Taiwan as a sovereign nation could or would, by extension, mean that Taipei was the legitimate ruler over all of China because there is only one China. And this is why Taiwan is such a serious problem for China. This isn't some kind of legal construct. It's really an intellectual construct that China stands by, or the government claims that it stands by. And so this isn't really a case of a breakaway province. This is a question of the legitimacy of the CCP's rule over the entirety of China. So the stakes are actually much higher than most people appreciate.
And so again, in the United States, for your average policymaker, say your average member of Congress, they probably think of Taiwan as somehow equivalent to Puerto Rico. And as important as Puerto Rico is, the United States doesn't think of Puerto Rico as existential to the sovereignty, to the identity, to the existence of the United States. Right? It's not a question about is the United States legitimate. But of course, that would be totally misapplied to understanding China's, meaning Beijing's relationship to Taiwan.
Right. Our audience should be aware that there was a very fiercely fought civil war over who would rule over China. And that civil war was unresolved. It wasn't that the KMT, the Anti-Communist Party, it wasn't that they lost. It was that they retreated to Taiwan and the conflict kind of stalled. It froze. And so America's role in the China-Taiwan conflict really gets to some very deep questions that go a lot farther back than 7 years, that really go back to who is the rightful heir of the continuation of what ended with the Qing Dynasty, of the fall of Imperial China. Who should be the rightful successor to Imperial China? The Chinese Communist Party says that it is the rightful successor. And the government in Taiwan, the KMT that founded what we now know as Taiwan, had a different vision. And so we're really delving into a question that has been unresolved for over a century, if you go back to the collapse of the last imperial dynasty in 1911, 1912.
Jeremy, I'd like you to respond to the following. I think that in Washington, there is a bit of a false dichotomy of hawkish versus dovish on China. But I think what's emerged is not a question of ideology, but to borrow a phrase from, I believe, the 1988 presidential campaign, it's really about competence, meaning how is the U.S. going to engage in competition or conflict with China, not whether. And I think that's a big problem, is that people assume that taking account of some of these factors we're discussing is a dovish position, when in fact it could be in service of a hawkish position, but you have to understand the contours and what's at stake.
Absolutely. And I'll just say that there are many different areas of competition with China that have actually fallen by the wayside. The current focus is Taiwan, which has tremendous economic ramifications. But there have been others over the years, areas which have been associated with very hawkish positions on China that have fallen by the wayside. For example, the pro-Tibetan cause has received almost no attention in D.C. over the past decade plus. Efforts to raise awareness and eventually improve the treatment of Christians in China and other persecuted minorities in China have either stalled or actually essentially shut down. There are many areas of U.S. competition with China that have been part of the picture over the past few decades, but it's only really with the focus on China over the past couple of years that competition, I'd say ideological competition with China, has bumped into issues of America's economic functioning and potential consequences for American consumers and voters.
And I think as we probably discussed, I'm pretty sure we discussed in a previous podcast, in many ways, the reflexive hawkish military position is an easy substitute for the harder challenge of reshoring and fortifying the U.S. economy and disaggregating the U.S.-China relationship. So it's much easier to increase the U.S. defense budget and spend a bunch of money on additional weapons and related programs than to disentangle the bilateral trade relationship. And so that's also one of these instincts, one of these tendencies that perhaps pushes the U.S. in a less than ideal direction.
What I would say, Jonathan, is from the beginning of this country, we've had a trade relationship with the Chinese. There were a lot of people in New England making money off of trade with China. In the 19th century, we were trading with the Chinese quite extensively. And it is not merely that there was this inflection point nearly 25 years ago with PNTR, which was, I believe, the subject of our first podcast. It's massively important historical moment, but it's one of many historical moments related to our trade with the Chinese. And I think that underscores the challenge of disaggregation and reshoring and why it's so tough and why it's much more convenient to avoid that whole discussion, because it's not clear from a historical perspective if we can really disentangle ourselves.
Well, a terrific conversation, an important conversation, something that we'll watch going forward. I want to thank you, Jeremy, for your expert insights. Johnny, you, as always, for your expert commentary. I want to thank you, our audience, for joining us for this edition of the Political Risk Brief.